3RPH is pleased to present the memoirs of Tilly Aston, Australia's blind poet, author and philanthropist. The story told of the many-faceted life of this talented woman is intriguing. The memoirs of Tilly Aston is published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. Episode 16.
At last we set sail for the north, and I was so tired with my 2 days of gaiety and excitement in the northern capital that I was glad to get to sea for a rest. It was during our stay there that I received a radiogram from Melbourne informing me that I had been decorated with the King's Medal for a second time in commemoration of the coronation of George VI and Queen Elizabeth. We were sailing up the Barrier Reef when the ceremony of crowning the sovereign was broadcast from London, but static spoilt the reception for us. The captain gave a coronation dinner and provided a souvenir menu card for each diner, with a dance to follow. This entertainment was enjoyed sitting on the deck in the tropical evening while the younger folk made merry in a broom dance or acted as jockeys for the deck horse racing. On this ship, I did not find the people very friendly. Blindness often produces that effect on strangers, who find it difficult to recognize the intelligent human being behind the darkened eyes. So I was not disturbed by it. A few of the old dears would sometimes venture to quiz Miss Bradford about me when I was out of the way. They would advise her that she ought to get my hair cut, as such long hair must be terrible trouble for her to keep in order and to do up for me. They also offered her congratulations on the nice way she dressed me, considering I was blind, and it must be very trying to have to do so much for me. My dear companion would grow indignant, protesting that I could do my own hair, dress myself, and generally care for my own needs, as well as they could for themselves. The laugh was ours in the privacy of our cabin. Two very interesting people I did meet on the ship. One was a quaint little gentleman from the goldfields of the north, Mr. Richard Terrell. He was wont to rise early, and so were we, that we might get a walk before breakfast and blow off the flavour of below decks. As the little gentleman would whiz round the promenade, he would meet us in passing, with the salute, "Hello, you flappers!" and we would give him back a laughing answer. Soon we became quite friendly, for he liked my opals. Anything from Queensland pleased him, and, as he remarked, I was sensible enough to know a good thing when it came my way. Added to this, I liked pawpaw, a fruit in which he delighted, and which he advocated as being health-giving as well. How trifling are the common grounds of congenial contact, by the way. He got off at Townsville, promising to call on us when he should be in Melbourne the following year. But before that happened, we saw an announcement of his death in the press. After he disembarked, the purser told us he was a great man in the north, a generous philanthropist, especially in providing schools, that he was known all over the state and had done much to develop its mining and other resources in the northern region. Odd in dress and tiny of stature, he was rather a joke to the other passengers, but he made this portion of our trip more interesting than it would have been, since he knew the land and the sea thereabouts, and the history of it as well, and was quite willing to talk about them to such friendly listeners as ourselves. The other traveller of importance to me was Mrs. Alice Jackson, editor of the Australian Woman's Weekly. She was on a cruise with her children, and I had several conversations with her. She gave me a valuable write-up in her paper, and also invited me to contribute an article, giving my impressions of the tour. At Sydney on my return journey, I made a broadcast in the session devoted to the interest of this paper, arranged while we were still sailing on the smooth, smiling waters of the tropical sea. It was a great privilege to meet this charming, though forceful, woman, for she wields a tremendous influence all over this continent through the medium of her much-read and widely circulated pages. How I should like to linger over my visit to Magnetic Island, and the afternoon I spent at Palm Island, with Aboriginal people, under the care of missionaries, nurses, and teachers. How I should like to tell of the many helping hands that guided me onto the launches and the smaller boats, that I might enjoy the excursions with the other tourists. But I must be content to remember it all, even if no space can be spared for a written record of so much kindness. We reached Cairns, and the same courtesy greeted me there. A long interview with me appeared in the social column of the Cairns paper, and I began to feel the reserve of my fellow passengers breaking down a little. We did the usual round of sights, and I met one or two old acquaintances who had sought a home and fortune in that warmer clime. I breathed the tropic airs, heard the sea on the reef, listened to the strange bird notes, handled the plants, hitherto but a name to me, and ate as much tropical fruit as I fancied. Up into the jungle, at Karanda, we went, and I perceived the voice of God in the mighty roar of the barren falls. If the other tourists got any more out of these things than I did, then they were fortunate indeed. At last we set sail for the south. I had arranged to get off at Mackay to spend a week with my friends Mr. and Mrs. Riddell, and to catch the next boat coming down from Cairns. The happy week there had, in addition to the pleasure of meeting Howard's bride for the first time, the chance of becoming acquainted with some of the Queenslanders in their own homes, and a certain amount of novelty of other kinds. Here we walked in the cane fields that gave us so much of our sugar, and heard of the rats and the death adders that sometimes hide there. We prowled in the bush among strange vegetation, drove through an avenue of mango trees, and examined the bananas on the plant in a garden surrounding a Kanaka's house. In this garden also grew the sweet potato and the rosella fruit, the large yellow guava and the prickly pineapple. How democratic were all the people we met! They went fishing and brought us their offerings of unlimited whiting. Such luxury! Their fruit would be found on our doorstep sometimes. Such cordiality made me long to linger among them, but the day arrived for our departure. We boarded the launch and glided out into the ocean near Flat Top Island, where we had to meet the ship Canberra. It had not come in sight when we got there, so we pulled in behind the isle for shelter, as the sea was beginning to rise. It was dark before the Canberra appeared, stealing towards us like a ghost out of the sea. It was growing cold, too, and mounting waves were rocking our little platform of a launch. When the steamer drew up beside us, the waves were swooping up her sides and falling back in terrifying flops between the two vessels. Down came the gangway above this turmoil, and the launch captain protested that it was dangerous, shouting that he had a blind lady to put aboard. No notice was taken of his objection. Then followed a scene which, but for its tragic possibilities, was one of the funniest that I have ever been called upon to share. The mate of the steamer would not give in, neither would our little Maltese captain. He shouted and swore, but the men up above continued to carry out their orders and prepared to get us up the gangway in spite of its broad swing up and down above us. I was seized by two men, ready to be pushed up to two of the sailors, whenever the movement of both vessels should make a contact possible. The next thing I knew was that I was lying flat on the launch, where I had been flung, and the Maltese skipper was dancing, shrieking mad, and hurling fierce invective at the men on the ship. He pulled the launch away and refused to load any more. I learnt that the end of the gangway had come down, with all the weight of the steamer behind it, just where I was standing, and had the men not been quick in throwing me backwards, I must have been crushed by its weight, or pushed into the turbulent water at our feet. After that we waited while the gangway was taken up, and that on the sheltered side of the steamer lowered for us. The launch steamed round there, and we transshipped, quite comfortably, both passengers and luggage. To those looking on, it had been a moment of terror. I received plenty of sympathy and congratulation, received credit for keeping calm in such great peril, but it must be confessed that not until afterwards did I realize the extent of the danger which I had escaped. As soon as we got to our cabin, the good-natured stewardess set about offering friendly consolation. I suffered no ill effects from this affair, but Miss Bradford, who witnessed the incident, was troubled for a long time over what might have happened, and enjoyed little more of the trip. Rough weather set in on our way down. A terrific cyclone between Brisbane and Sydney made the going heavy indeed, and no one could get up for meals. I managed to consume some turkey by gripping the berth with one hand and feeding myself in the primitive forkless fashion. We were glad to reach the harbour city and to go ashore for some food in peace. The broadcast arranged for the Women's Weekly was given, and my cousin Jack Herbertson drove us round the resorts and watering places. At last we came outside Port Phillip Heads one morning before dawn, where the sea was blanketed with fog, and we were forced to wait outside for 8 hours until visibility was good enough to permit a safe passage through the Rip and up the bay to the city port. I need not say that our homecoming gave us as much satisfaction as our setting forth had given. Into 5 weeks had been crowded as much excitement and adventure as usually came my way in as many years. I had been in wonderful places, had met wonderful people, and now, weary but happy, I was back in my cozy old cot, where I can sit and recall the grandeur of the Barren Falls, the weird silence of Lake Eacham and Barine, the Kanakas who dwell outside Mackay, and more than all, the inspired kindness, gifts of flowers, fruit, and lovely souvenirs which were lavished upon me from the beginning to the end of my voyage. Later years at the AAB. At the time of writing this chapter, February 1945, the Jubilee year of the Association for the Advancement of the Blind had almost arrived. In the course of half a century of active work for my handicapped fellows, it is natural that we should have faced some periods of crisis. I have mentioned one which affected me greatly, when I entered the education department. Another occurred when the association, at the suggestion of the Charities Board, entered into a financial agreement with the Royal Victorian Institute for the Blind. By this agreement, we surrendered to the other party all our means of gathering funds, subscriber lists, collectors, concert itineraries, etc., and in return we were to receive an agreed fixed sum with which to conduct our activities. But the arrangement did not prove sufficiently plastic, and when, after 2 or 3 years, we asked for a revision of the conditions, the Institute summarily broke the agreement. We were left stranded with no source of revenue and were forced to begin over again building up our position, and since then our work has never looked back. I have mentioned my return to the presidential chair, and I was happy to be in office again and making myself useful to the organisation. For some years things went smoothly, and things were satisfactory in all respects. But I was unfortunate in getting an infection in the right hand, and for nearly a year could not use that important member, while my health was on that account inadequate for any kind of public work. I offered to resign, but the members re-elected me, on the understanding that the vice president should perform all the routine tasks for me, leaving me free to regain my strength at my own fireside. In the meantime, a small body of the members began to show dissatisfaction with this arrangement. They came to the meetings, practicing obstructionist tactics, delaying business and making the duties of the chairman both arduous and unpleasant. Most of the members of this small coterie were in the younger group, and with the confidence of youth, they thought that they could manage the affairs of the association more successfully than those who had founded and carried on the work for so many years. They wanted to wrest all power from the existing committee, and had not shown themselves willing to come in and learn, and gradually take over the burden, as the older ones dropped out. At length, in the early part of 1943, this ferment culminated in a demand for a special meeting of the whole body of members, to which notice was given of a motion to remove from office the president and other members of the committee, because of their age, health, condition, or incompetence. The group which demanded this meeting to clean up the personnel comprised less than 25 out of our 550-odd members, and from the beginning it was apparent that this minority had plans for taking over the affairs of the organisation themselves. I am convinced that they had no conception of the amount of work, nor the difficulties which faced them, nor did they realise how necessary it is to grow into work like this, as our long-tried committee had done. The meeting was called, and everybody had his say. The malcontents got no support from the general body. The meeting voted for the retention of the old committee by an overwhelming majority, and though bitterly hurt by this attempt to discredit the work of myself and my colleagues, I, for one, hoped that in due time the storm would pass, and that the younger set would be induced to cooperate with the older workers and so gradually fit themselves to carry the responsibility. We who had done so for 40 years knew that our term of usefulness must come to an end in the future, and we were anxious to secure the continuity of the work on the same democratic lines in which it had been conceived, even when we should be no longer here to watch over it. But just before this no-confidence meeting was held, another blow fell upon us, which was infinitely more grievous to me than the noisy, bumptious criticisms of my young blind friends. In the state of Victoria, as is well known, there exists a Charities Act under which organisations of a philanthropic kind may be incorporated. But such incorporation carries with it a form of government differing essentially from ours in the Association for the Advancement of the Blind, whose constitution gave every member equal rights. From the beginning, it had been my object to give the blind members the final say in their own affairs, and in order to promote this policy, every member must be blind and have a vote on every question. Incorporated societies are controlled by a committee elected by the subscribers only, a mode of government differing from the one we had pursued. But always we had had cooperating with us a small group of sighted people, willing to let us run our association in our own way, and happy to know that we should thus realize our citizenship in service, and accepting for our sakes a back seat in the chariot of independence we drove. Now the aggressive younger set, by their rudeness and obstruction, gave offence to some of these non-blind friends. A few of them got together, without the knowledge of one blind member, and in spite of the dissent of a majority of the seeing workers, drew up a petition to the Charities Board, begging that we be forced to incorporate, and they secured the necessary 25 signatures before presenting it. This petition was signed by no important officer, such as the President, the Treasurer, and the Chairman of the Finance Committee. From time to time, our work had been surveyed by the Charities Board, and had never received anything but commendation. So the Chief Inspector, knowing the peculiar constitution under which we had conducted our affairs, thought that the blind, who had in 48 years built up a fine organisation and large assets, had some rights as well as the sighted citizen, who merely contributed £1 a year. Thus there began months of negotiation, endless meetings and conferences, in which we found the Charities Board friendly, but the Charities Act not quite so accommodating. We were anxious to arrive at a scheme of government which would still leave some power in the hands of the blind themselves, and we sought the help of a good legal firm with specialist knowledge of such work. I shall never cease to be grateful to Mr. John Adam, the man of law who took up our cause. Every step was guarded and watched by him, to close every loophole which might leave us vulnerable, and in the end an incorporated constitution was drawn up, the members and contributors adopting it at their respective summoned meetings. So in the year 1944, we started out on new lines. As founder and leader of this society, this brotherhood of the sightless for nearly half a century, I have accepted what seems to me the best settlement. Nevertheless, I am compelled to acknowledge that I do so with deep sorrow and disappointment, since I am convinced that our brotherhood is no more, and that a deadly blow has been delivered to our people in the very centre and soul of their independence and self-respect. Quite a definite share in the management has been preserved for them, but it is no longer the unique vehicle of self-expression that was always my aim, and whose strong spirit was maintained through the years in the face of fluctuating interests and opposition. Into our ranks had crept the unrest of the time, with its destructive, iconoclastic tendency, yet offering nothing to replace the old order satisfactorily. The whole affair would not have been so bitter to me if it had been free from the element of treachery and intrigue, and I grieve for my lost child. I try to comfort my heart by owning that our work is now important and our assets considerable, and that perhaps the time for a change had come. I can only hope that the lifelong labours of myself and my comrades, fostered and encouraged by so many seeing members of the community, may not suffer any check through the tempest that lately passed over us. But I may be forgiven if I mourn a little over the old and cherished ways, for I still hold steadfastly to my former love. I still think it would be better to make mistakes in managing ourselves than to submit to be managed by others. After a lapse of a year, the pain has become less poignant, and my chief desire is that the work shall go on, though I shall soon be no longer a part of it. At a meeting of the contributors called to adopt the new constitution, I delivered a brief summary of the position which I have decided to include later, because I want the world to know how ardent, how sincere, how tenacious we were in our efforts to raise the status of the blind. And I print this speech to refute any secret insinuation that we did anything but the best for the cause for which we laboured. In 1945, we are celebrating the jubilee of the association. We are proud of what has been accomplished, and my personal feeling is one of thankfulness, since I have been able to add my weight to the pull. With sincere purpose, I have placed at the service of the blind of this state all of the talents I possessed, striving for better conditions in which they must shoulder their handicap. I feel that it is but fair to mention that I never received wages or salary for my part in this work, for I fought my own economic problem as a musician, teacher, and writer. The sense of satisfaction is dearer to me than any material reward. I have done my bit, and the future must be the richer for it.
And that brings us to the end of episode 16 of The Memoirs of Tilly Aston, published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pam Adams. The series was produced in the studios of 3RPH Melbourne for the RPH Network.